Hey, what's going on, my friend? Alex Pardo here. You're listening to another Masterclass Flip Empire podcast show, episode 228.
Welcome to the Flip Empire Show, bringing you the interviews, strategies, and insights for smart real estate investors. Prepare to dive into the minds of real estate's heavy hitters and gain the cutting-edge expertise you need to scale and grow your real estate empire. Your success and freedom starts now with your host, Alex Pardo.
What's going on? What's going on? Hope you guys are doing phenomenal today. And guys, I got my buddy John Carcone on the podcast today here. And I want to give you a little bit of background so you know, because John's not somebody who's, you know, is out there in the podcast scene or the speaking circuit. Just a dude that, you know, did his first deal back in 2009. Prior to that, he had a background in sales. You know, he had various sales management roles, you know, graduated with a business degree, went to college in North Carolina. And 2009, you know, he always had the bug to start his own business, you know, similar story to a lot of people, but he actually did something with that. So 2009, took down his first deal. 2010, he started rehabbing and wholesaling. And then started to ramp up from there and, you know, got to the point where I think last year, you know, did about 40 something deals. Half of those were fix and flip. Half of those were rehabs. And what's interesting is, you know, in about the, since 2009, I think he's done well over 160 deals. You know, 50 of those or so have been wholesale, about 110 rehabs. And so this dude has done like small rehabs where, you know, he'll put 20, 30 into a deal. And he's done rehabs where he's, you know, he's put about 400,000 into the deal. Matter of fact, one of the case studies that we cover on this podcast is a how he took like a brownstone building essentially and converted it into a two unit. And he put about $215,000 into that project. And now that deal's netting him $1,700 a month. So what we're going to cover on this particular podcast is, you know, we're going to talk about the ups and downs, you know, a lifestyle business versus actually building a real business. We kind of get into the nitty gritty with that. And then we talk about his niche, which is high-end rentals, not something that we've covered on the podcast before. So, this one's going to be an interesting for you. Let's dive right into it. Hey John, what's going on, brother? How are you?
Hey man, good. How are you doing?
I'm doing awesome, buddy. Thank you for hopping on, man. And again, thanks for being flexible with me last week. So guys, John and I were supposed to record this podcast last week, and I came down like I caught something that just put me out of commission. And so yeah, man, I appreciate you being flexible with me and rescheduling here.
Yeah, man, no worries.
Yeah, buddy. So how's everything going on your end, man? What's going on since we last connected?
Yeah, you know, it's good, you know, like we had kind of talked about, you know, just the cost per deal and stuff is going up a little bit. So
right.
I'm just kind of trying to figure out, you know, what things I need to change to just make sure I'm getting a good enough return on the marketing, especially with, you know, having more overhead now. Like we moved into an office at the turn of the year and hired two new employees. So yeah, it's sort of like, you know, making sure that I make this work, you know, as a business, as opposed to the last bunch of years where it was more of a solo thing that I was doing with virtual assistant help, more of a lifestyle kind of business. So yeah, it's been definitely a transition and lots of opportunities to learn.
Yeah, man. So I think what you just said there at the end is kind of where I want to start, and then we'll circle back to a little bit of your story here. But I think it's exactly right, man. I think, you know, we all experience those growing pains, you know, where we start to build a team. Well, I shouldn't say we all, but a lot of people, you know, you start to build a team and, you know, you incur more overhead and you have marketing challenges and you have, you know, deal volume challenges, like we were talking offline. But it's about having that right mindset. It's all an opportunity to grow, get better. And man, I don't know anybody that has built up a successful business that hasn't had their fair share of challenges. So, you know, I think that's one of the things, John, if it's cool with you, man, I'd like to kind of talk about some of those challenges, because, you know, I've experienced, right now we're experiencing a little bit of a deal volume challenge. You and I were talking offline, and I think people learn just as much, if at least I can only speak for myself, man. I learn more from listening to other people's quote unquote failures. And I put failures in quotes because I don't see them as failures. I see them as learning opportunities. Mm-hmm. But I learned just as much from that, you know, if not more than I do from like the success stories. I mean, if I want success stories, all I got to do is hop on Facebook, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's nice to hear the real story. You know, I mean, no one's life is perfect. Doesn't matter what doesn't matter what you're doing. Everyone has things that they're not happy with that they need to work on, whether it's a business thing or a personal thing or whatever. I mean, just that's just life, you know? And so the more varnished pictures that we get through social media and stuff like that definitely aren't a genuine reflection of what the reality is.
Yeah, exactly. Let's kind of start from the beginning though. You got started in this business full time around 2012. Is that right?
Yep. Full time 2012. I started at 2009, 2010-ish. So it was about 2 or 3 years before I went full time, and then full time at the end of 2012. That's right.
Okay. Got it. And then so the first, what you'd say 3-4 years, you know, you kind of, I think the phrase you used was it was more of a lifestyle business.
Yeah, exactly. So like from when I went full-time in 2012, I mean, I think I was just burned out after 3 years of having two jobs, basically, you know, like where I had a full-time management consulting sales job. And then I was also trying to do this real estate thing. So I think I was just like burned out, and I just wanted to have the freedom and the flexibility that, you know, you hear about in like the podcasts and in different, you know, books and stuff like that. And so for, yeah, probably until like maybe early to mid 2016. So about 3-4 years, you know, I was working maybe like, you know, 30 hours a week or something like that. I would renovate anywhere between like 12 and 20 houses a year. And you know, was pulling down like a good amount of money. So yeah, I was just kind of like enjoying that, you know, and it was a good time in the market where I was able to do that. I found most of my stuff at that time on the MLS.
Yep.
So that made it, you know, kind of a lot easier, and that made that possible.
Dude, wasn't it like, I remember 2013 and 14, getting deals off the MLS, it was like shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, it was, you know, there's no issue, you know, like the only issue I had was just I didn't have enough money to take them down. But like, you know, I would just, it would literally be, I would spend an hour a day for years, you know, for maybe 3 years. I spent an hour a day looking at all the new properties that came on the MLS. I would send it off to my virtual assistant who would make, you know, 10 to 25 offers a day. And I would get like, you know, 2 or 3 houses a month that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I was about the same. And so my numbers were, we would send between 50 and 60 offers a day. And that would usually, so that's what, roughly you're talking 250, 300 offers a month. We were doing about 4 or 5 deals just from about 250 to 300 offers that we would send. And we had it like all automated and stuff. And dude, it was...
Oh man, so much easier, man, than all this motivated seller stuff. You know, you got the freaking mail and phone calls and the sales appointments. It's a whole different thing.
But that's interesting, man. I kind of want to dive into that a little bit because I think a lot of people that listen to the show, you know, it's not, if anything, it's more of a lifestyle business than what, you know, you and I are working towards building now, an actual business that, you know, can live and breathe and grow without you, right? Versus what, you know, and I'm with you, man. So, the majority of, you know, I've been in this business 12, 13 years, and, you know, pretty much the first, man, 8-9 years, I would say for sure, it was just me and a VA, and I was making good money. But, you know, if I stopped working, money stopped coming in, but I knew I just had to put in a little bit of time and I'd make money. Right. So, and by the way, I think that's perfectly fine for some people. I think you just really got to get clear on what you want. Like, you know, what does your vision look like? And if that's the kind of business you want, then that's perfectly fine. You know, there's no right or wrong. But if you want to build a business that, you know, potentially someday can be sellable, that you can exit out of, or just a business that, again, is going to, you know, you can go on vacation for 30, 60, 90 days and it's doing better without you than it did with you. You know, at least for me, that's what I strive for. And I think you're kind of in the same boat.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, it's definitely, you know, and in the groups that, you know, you and I are part of, you know, we hear guys talk about that. I mean, that's a thing that I think a lot of us, even building the business, kind of can struggle with and can waffle around on, or at least I do, which is, you know, ultimately this is for a lifestyle. And even building the business is to help support the lifestyle, you know, that I want. And I don't want to have some big company. I don't want to be working a lot, and I'm willing to make a little less money because of that, but I do want to be like as hands off as possible to have just maximum flexibility and just sort of autonomy. Yep. And like, you know, I basically had that, and I kind of gave a good chunk of that up to build this business. And part of me is like, you know, why the hell don't I just go back to what I was doing before, sort of thing. But again, you know, like we just kind of talked about, it is in this market now, we, you know, can't do it that way anymore. So you know, you'd be calling back the sellers, you'd be going on the appointments. And so it doesn't really quite work, at least in the market right now, you know, for that. So it's sort of a necessary evil, I guess, right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And what does your business model look like today? So around mid 2016 or so, you decided, you know, I want to build this thing. I want to, you know, actually build this to be a business, yep, that, you know, that grows. What is, cause I know you have some rentals in upstate New York, but I think you said your primary market's DC.
Yep. So I'm in the DC market. So I live in downtown DC. Our office is in Northern Virginia, like basically just outside the city limits. And the team is, I've got an inside sales guy. I've got an outside sales guy who's a friend of mine, who's basically going to be sort of a partner in the business over time. Then I have an operations person. And then I have a full-time virtual assistant, okay, as well. So I guess basically I have those four people.
Okay. Got it, guy. And you guys primarily are doing fix and flips, you wholesale, and you're targeting rentals, right?
That's right. Yeah. So it's like kind of the three-prong sort of thing, you know? So like last year I did like 43 deals and like 23 were rehabs and 20 were wholesales.
Okay.
So I'm kind of shooting for hopefully something similar, kind of half and half, but I will take stuff down. Like if I can only make, let's say, 20 wholesaling it, but I could make, you know, like 40 or 50 rehabbing it, then I'm being greedy because I just don't have the deal volume still where I can sort of afford to not be greedy and do the easier money. So I kind of have to, so I take it down to make the more money and rehab it. And then, yeah, in the rental side, I'm doing some rentals in DC, and then I have student rentals as well, because that's my ultimate really goal is even, you know, the business is part of the goal in one way it could go if it goes well and I can make it where it's hands off. But my sort of backup and my additional thing that I'm ultimately trying to do, and I know you talk about this as well, is cash flow. So I'm trying to get to 10,000 a month in cash flow.
Okay.
And I'm like going to be a few, you know, $2,500 away, hopefully in like in the next 6 months or so. And so, you know, at least if I get there, I'll know that if the world collapses, you know, at least, as long as rents don't collapse, I'll have that money coming in, and that if I so chose, I could just unspool this whole thing and I could just and have my lifestyle be covered.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that you said that, because I've had so many conversations with guys in our group that you and I both know, you know, guys that have, you know, 150, a rental portfolio of 150 free and clear properties, and they walk and talk a little different. And I don't mean that in like a bragging or negative kind of way. It's just they have this, it's almost like a safe, they walk around with like a safety net under them. And I think it speaks to your point that, you know, you ask them, hey, you know, what are your thoughts on the market? How are you kind of repositioning your business? And, you know, one particular guy, I won't mention his name, he was like, I don't really care, you know, because, and the reason is because, you know, the dude has, you know, over 100 free and clear single family, you know, rental portfolio that, regardless, you know, that cash is coming in, and yeah, that doesn't go without its challenges and vacancies and management issues and, you know, that kind of stuff. But it's not going to happen to the majority of his portfolio. You know, it might be some one-offs here and there. And so, yeah, man, I think wholesaling is a phenomenal business. I think it's a great cash generator. But it's ultimately, what are you going to put that money into that you generate to provide you that cash flow? You know, that this year, that's been a big focus of mine. When did you start picking up these rentals and the student housing deals?
So when I first got into this in 2009, that was kind of why, sort of how I sort of started to get the bug, I guess, or whatever, is I had saved up enough money at my job where I could buy a house, and I didn't want to just have a regular house. I wanted to have a duplex or a multi-unit where the rent would cover most of the mortgage. Mm-hmm. So that was the first rental I did, was 2009. I did a two-unit, and then I did a bunch of like lower end rentals in kind of like the 2011, 2012, which was an amazing time to buy. But I didn't know, I mean, I knew a lot about screening, I thought, but apparently I didn't apply it because I got basically my butt handed to me by those.
You can't say that without getting into some of the war stories, man.
Yeah, man. So like, you know, so I think especially if you're, you know, more on the ambitious side or whatever, like you're more attracted to the raw numbers. Like the lower end rentals look so sexy when you see that you can buy something and be all in for like at this time it was like 60 or 70 grand. It would run for 1300 a month.
Yep.
You know, you were like at that like 2% rule. It just, the numbers look so sick. But that lower end stuff, I mean, like the amount of people you have to sort of filter through to find someone with even a credit score over, let's say, 600, you know, is huge. So I had evictions on, I bought sort of four all around the same time, and I had evictions on, I think, like three of the four, you know, that I had to do. And so, especially in a state like Maryland that has more tenant-friendly laws, you know, it's like a 6-month, 8-month process, man. So it's like, it's just, you know, you just get your butt totally, you know, like handed to you, basically.
Yeah, you got kicked in the balls, yeah.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I keep wanting to swear, but I'm trying not to. you know, and so that really kind of put, like, that probably took me out of the game for like 2 years. I think like I was like, had like PTSD or something, you know, before I finally started buying stuff again. And then, you know, I ended up kind of picking it back up again, but doing the higher end rentals that I do now, because I just didn't want to, I'm still kind of afraid to go back there a little bit. And so, yeah, that's when I started to switch to like the stuff I'm doing in DC, converting to 2 units, and then the student rentals, because my brothers went to school in a good area for that. So that's kind of when I switched to that strategy.
Well, man, John, so before we pivot into like the higher end rentals, because that's not, I mean, we've talked about cash flow. We've talked about, you know, single family rentals, multifamily. We've never talked about, you know, student housing deals per se and some of the high end rentals. But what was the, before we kind of get into some of that stuff, man, what was the biggest lesson or takeaway that that you got from that experience of just, you know, buying rentals, low end rentals that, you know, the returns look phenomenal on paper, but then reality hits you in the face?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, I don't know if this is that profound or whatever, but I mean, one of the things I definitely did wrong was I tried to price it at the top end of the market to get the best possible return.
When you underwrote the deal, you weren't being conservative. You were like assuming best case scenario.
The deal was, the way I underwrote it was okay. But I mean, like where I set the rents when I advertised it was at the top end. So like I wasn't getting enough of a candidate flow of tenants to be able to be picky enough.
Got it.
And find that sort of diamond in the rough. And it is a diamond in the rough, like in a lot of areas and those kind of rentals. So if I was just like, instead of pricing at $1,350, if I priced it at, let's say $1,250 or $1,225 or something, probably would have been flooded. And I probably could have found someone decent, you know, that met all the criteria you need. So that's just a tactical thing that I think really, I just made it a lot harder. And I just wasn't picky enough with who I ended up putting in there.
Okay. So it sounded like you kind of filtered more of the decision, what tenant you were going to put into your properties based on the maximum amount of rent you could get versus actually, you know, screening them and making sure you get good quality tenants in there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like luckily, I mean, I knew enough where I would look at credit score and income and the kind of job they had and all that kind of stuff. But like, it just wasn't enough people where like I ended up being like, okay, here's 10 people and I'm going to pick the best of these 10, let's say, on all these factors. But I needed to probably have looked at 50. You know, or 75. And because I priced it a little on the high end, I wasn't getting enough people where I had enough volume to actually find that person.
Got it. Understood. Okay. So after about 2 years of that, you know, you had some big lessons learned. But how did you start getting into like the high end rentals? And if you can kind of break down what that means for somebody listening.
Yeah. So, you know, this one in that we bought in 2009, so that was just like kind of just the typical young working professional types who are going to be wanting to work like in or near kind of a city center. They have really good credit scores. They have really good income. They have really stable jobs. Just really just kind of low hassle, you know, who you just won't have to worry about them paying rent.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I guess I sort of roughly kind of define it. And so all this time while I was having all these issues, you know, the property that we had in Northern Virginia, that was an $800,000 property that would rent for, to give some numbers, $800,000 property that rents for, what is it? About $7,500 a month across the 2 units.
Okay.
And so, you know, these are just these, you know, cause in the DC area, the numbers are just, you know, a little higher end or whatever. And so throughout that whole time, I had no issue with these tenants. So I was like, why am I messing around with a tenant profile that I'm just not that like familiar with and comfortable with? Like, let me just go back to what I sort of like know and have had no issues with over the last 4 or 5 years. And so that's when I decided to try to buy some stuff in the actual city of DC. And I also liked the secular kind of like story of like the rejuvenation of city centers. And I felt like that had still a ways to go, like was a long-term kind of like overarching kind of trend. And I wanted to kind of hitch my wagon to what I was seeing happening. So that's kind of why I sort of pivoted.
And dude, you know what's interesting from, you know, listening to your story is most people, you know, they think rental property, they don't think high end, right? Obviously, unless you're right. talking about, you know, multifamily or some sort of commercial property. And a lot of people, I think, would be scared away by those numbers. So I kind of want to get into, like, you know, maybe you can take one, you know, one of your deals and we can kind of like break it down as a case study, you know, how you found it, what you're into it at, you know, how you took the property down, and then what some of the numbers look like, you know, once you got it like fully rented.
Yeah. Cool. So yeah, I'll pick one that like I'm just literally now completing, and we have the one lease signed and are about to have a second lease signed. So this is one that's in, it's in downtown DC. We bought it for $515. Okay. This is from actually like a friend of mine. He's sort of like a joint venture partner and kind of more of a, he's a newer investor basically that feeds me deals sometimes. And so he actually found it. And the way he found it was, it would either have been direct mail or cold calling.
What kind of property is this?
This is a row house. Essentially, it's a townhouse in sort of a more of a city center type. So it's like almost like a brownstone in Brooklyn or something kind of look to it a little bit.
Yep. Okay. And what was the, when so you bought it at, you said 515 or 550?
515.
515. What would you say the after repaired value was?
So after repaired value, it actually just got appraised at 950.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot of margin there.
Yeah, there's a lot of margin. You know, I mean, I had to put a ton of money into it, you know, but it's still, you know, the decent, like a little equity cushion in there.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. So this is like a JV partner that brought you the deal. He probably got it from direct mail. You took it down. I think you had told me offline you used hard money on that one, right?
Yeah. So I use essentially hard money. It's actually a bank credit line is what I use. So it's, you know, like kind of the 5 or 6% interest range, which especially in like these higher price properties just makes a big difference, you know? So I use a line of credit to take it down. And then I ended up putting about, after permits and everything, probably about like 215 or 220 in it. And then I had holding costs and closing costs and stuff. So I'm probably into it for like 775 or something.
Okay. Got it. Has there been ever, you know, I know the goal for you is cash flow, but have you been tempted to turn around and flip that property?
No, because it's kind of my strategy, you know, like, so I want to at least have a few a year sort of like this, you know, because I kind of also want to own, you know, like let's say 7 to 10 million or something in real estate within a handful of years. So like I kind of have to hold on to stuff. So it kind of fit my strategy. So yeah, I was cool to just kind of leave that equity kind of sitting there.
Okay, got it. And this is the property that you're converting. So this is like you said, a row. It's like a, I'm just going to call it a brownstone because that's what I'm familiar with. So essentially you're turning the top floor into a unit and the bottom floor into a whole separate unit.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So in this case, it's a three level property. So basement, ground floor, and top floor. So the top floor is a unit and then the bottom two floors are a duplex unit. So it's two units total in the building.
Okay. And but, is this like, would you consider, is this a student housing type property?
No, this isn't. This is just young professional type, you know, like it's a lot of just like, you know, they're 24, they're 25, you know what I mean? They have maybe their first or second job. They're making 60, 70 grand a year or something like that. And then we try to have more bedrooms if possible, try to get a larger property. So like one is a four bedroom and then one is a two bedroom.
Okay, got it. So what do you think each unit is going to rent for? You know, because I think you had said that you're in the process of finishing it up, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we have one lease signed. The total should be $6,500 to $6,600 a month.
Okay.
In gross rent. So, I mean, I try to get like as close to that 1% rule. I mean, obviously like 2% on a lower end is where I'd want to be in terms of like the gross rent to the total like investment, but in sort of the higher price, if I get close to 1%, like if it's 800K, if it rents for 8,000 a month, then I'm pretty happy. So I try to get it like as close to that sort of as I can. And also when I refi, of course, like I try to buy it deep enough where I can get a good chunk of my investment back.
Yep. Exactly. Cause how much of your own money do you have into this deal?
Yeah. So I have a ton. I mean, I have like, I have probably, let's see, yeah, probably like 200 grand or something.
Okay. And when you refi, are you going to be able to take most of those chips off the table?
I should be able to have maybe like 130 or so in it. So, I mean, I still have to have a big chunk in it because I just didn't buy it steep enough on this one. Like ideally, you'd buy it deeper. So it just depends on like how much cash I have at the time and how good of deals I can find. You know what I mean? It's sort of mm-hmm. But yeah, on this one, yeah, I'll probably still have like 130 left and I'll get maybe 70 back when I refi.
Got it. And when you factor out the debt service, everything else, taxes, insurance, the whole nine, what do you expect to net on this particular deal?
Should be about like 1800 a month.
Dude, that's awesome.
Thanks, man.
That's good. Thanks, man. That's good. I mean, it's a high priced property, obviously, but and it sounds like I'm curious how long that rehab took you, but I mean, you're netting close to $2,000, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah. I mean, that's what kind of excites me. I mean, just, I guess everyone's a different personality type and stuff, and we're all in different areas too. Like I wish I was in like Indianapolis or something like that, and I could just buy like bread and butter type rentals all day, and I live super close and just could have like 100 of them. Like that'd be awesome, but that's just not a possibility, in my area, unless I want to go kind of like the lower end again, which I'm hesitant to do, So it's sort of like, this is sort of the opportunity available. And like on the plus side, at least it like takes big chunks out of that like cash flow goal that I have, once I finally get these things done, but they are they're a beast, to renovate.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just curious, man, you're the thought process. How did you end up on the higher end rentals? At some point, did you ever, and I'm really just kind of curious because I'm, I've actually decided to go outside my market because for similar reasons, it's hard to, find cash flowing producing properties that are in, good B to C plus areas, right? Yeah. Did you ever consider kind of pivoting completely from your business and maybe looking at commercial, or did you consider, going into a different market to buy and hold?
Yeah, totally. So like there was probably maybe 6 to 8 months where I was going pretty hard for mobile home parks for that exact reason. Like I really would love ideally to have an apartment, but the way the apartment market has been, I felt like it might be even less likely to find an apartment deal that made sense mm-hmm. than a mobile home park. So I went mobile home parks and I went super hard at that. And I got kind of close on a couple. I was doing direct mail and cold calling to park owners. And I got kind of close on a couple of them. But then, I like visited some and it was kind of a similar thing. Like, I'm sure it's fine, but it's just not something that I have a natural like comfort with. Like you could get there easily. It wouldn't be a problem, but like, it's just not something that I'm like just naturally sort of like, oh yeah, like this, it just made me kind of nervous. I'm like more of a cautious person. Yeah. So that's when I was like, well, screw it. I'm just going to double down and just buy more of these higher end things and try to get, like, I don't know, 8 or 10 of them.
Okay. So that's the long-term goal right now. I mean, you're going to continue to fix and flip and do some wholesale to kind of feed the end game of taking down these higher end rentals.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I am still continuing to try to build it out, hopefully as a business that can run, without me as well. So I sort of, ideally I'll have a business that runs mostly without me or at least partially, plus mm-hmm. I'll have hopefully the cash flow. That would be sort of the ideal. But even if one of those two things works out, then I'll still be good. So I'm trying to have a little bit of like a kind of a redundancy.
Yeah. No, I get it. No, man, I'm telling you, I think the wholesaling business is awesome because you can make a lot of money, it's a simple business, but it's not easy, if that makes any sense. I guess what I mean by that is that there's nothing complicated about the wholesaling business for the fix and flipping, but there's a lot of moving parts, like you and I were talking about, man, in 2012, 13, 14, just scooping properties right off the MLS from agents, feeding you deals. Like my overhead was next to nothing. Right. Yep. But now when you start to hire, build a team and you start to, factor in different marketing channels like direct mail and cold calling and PPC, it's, you got to have your systems dialed in. You got to have the right people on your team. And I mean, to me, it's a challenge. But yeah, there's times where honestly, it can feel like a grind.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I feel totally like I feel the same way, And, also the tighter the market gets, the more dialed in you have to be, Last year, I could just kind of throw money at it and just worked, And I didn't have to pay too much attention.
Yeah.
But this year, I'm throwing money at it and it's not quite working.
Why don't we kind of like start to kind of wind down and wrap up the show with talking about that? Because I think a lot of people can relate to what you and I are talking about. As the market gets tighter, inventory starting to kind of dry up, especially if you're looking at the MLS, at some point, whenever that might be, maybe we have another year, year and a half, 2 years left on the coastal markets. When things start to kind of turn and the market shifts, like you said, man, I think you hit the nail on the head. You really, really got to have your systems dialed in. I think, one of the things I'm realizing, John, is we can send out, I mean, we can source the best direct mail list out there. We can go after the specialty niche list. And yeah, we can spend time talking about, like, you know, tips, tricks, techniques, and strategies and things you can do to generate more leads. And we can talk about lead conversion, but some of that stuff is kind of outside our control to a certain degree. Like in other words, we can get the best list and we can get an amazing, you know, direct mail piece. We can send it out. But at the end of the day, you don't control who calls in. And yes, there's things you can do like stacking your list to, you know, try to focus on the most motivation possible. But one of the things that I think where I'm going with this is that one of the things I'm kind of starting to realize more and more, the one thing we have control over are the people that we hire and bring on our team. Mm-hmm. You know, and if I think, especially as the market gets tighter and eventually when the market shifts, I think the entrepreneurs that have the best teams, like the talented people that just fit their culture, fit their core values, assuming they've defined those things, you know, I really think that's where it's at, man. I mean, I look at some of the guys in the group that we're a part of, and, you know, I think the guys that really just have their stuff dialed in, they have the talented rock star people and they have a hiring system and they've built it out the right way. You know what I mean?
Definitely. Yeah, I think that's right. You know, and I think, and that's an area that, you know, I've definitely been hit or miss on for sure, you know, with my people. It just makes such a huge difference. I mean, like an A player to like a B minus player or something, I feel like it's not like 10% better. It's like 50 or 75%, like more out of them, like better, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, bringing on, making the bad hire, I mean, that sets you back, dude. Like, it just, you know, totally. Because all the time, energy, and resources you spend into training that person to then, you know, 3, 4, 5 months down the road, just realize this person's not the right fit. They're just not in the right seat, you know?
Absolutely.
It sets you back, you know? And I think I've talked about this on previous podcasts in the past. I'd be so quick. It was kind of like that game Hot Potato. You know, I'd be so quick to just not want to do something that I would hire without going through a certain process. And I've taken my lumps over the years doing it that way. Obviously, that's not the way to do it. But yeah, that's the one thing that I think we have control over is, you know, the people we bring onto our business. So
yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. You know, and I think like we've been talking about, like, as the market gets tighter, that just all that stuff, all that business stuff that, you know, you're supposed to do well, you know, that maybe you haven't had to really do, like, just gets so much more important to do right. So you have to make sure that you could have, you know, 100 podcasts on hiring people, right? I mean, it's definitely like it's art and science certainly together, but finding the right people is so critical.
Yeah. And no, and again, it's, you know, we're just talking here. It's easier said than done, but there is a way to do it. There is an art to it. Right. And I think, man, it's interesting because I think newbies coming into this market and just doing crazy stuff. I mean, there's a lot more noise in the marketplace now with all the fix and flip shows and seminars hitting every big city in Miami, or I'm sorry, every big city in the country every other weekend. There's a lot more noise. So you really have to stand out, separate yourself. And, you know, I mean, let's be honest, man, hot markets are very forgiving, you know, but let's see what happens when things start to get even tighter. And I really think that, you know, those people that just have all their systems tightened up and they just have everything. Those are the people that are going to see it on the other end of the market, you know?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, and that's what's, you know, definitely scary for any operator is when the market turns and when, you know, there's always that lag between what a seller thinks is happening in the market and what's really happening, you know? So the sellers are still going to think it's a good market and maybe it's turned a little bit on the investment side for what we can wholesale a deal for, what we can sell it for on the back end.
Yeah.
But some of us haven't realized that yet. And you've got that time, that 6 months or 12 months or whatever it is, where, you know, it's hard to buy, but it's not as easy to sell. And, and that's where I think, it's going to be, that's what's even more important than it is now, you know? So yeah, just trying to get everything straight for that and the metrics and the people and, you know, tracking exactly what your ROI is on everything. Yeah. I think that's it's going to be really important.
The data is so big, man. You got to pay attention to the data and, you know, you want to start to see before you realize that your bank account is shrinking, look at what's happening to your marketing. Assuming you're doing marketing, if you're not doing marketing, that's probably a big reason. But if you are doing the marketing is always going to tell the story. You know, again, we were talking offline, how direct mail, you know, response rates are just super, super down. Right. And that starts to kind of tell a story, You know what I mean? You really have to kind of pay attention to those things.
Yeah.
I think you said something last year, you could just kind of throw money at the problem, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I wouldn't have to think too much about it. You would just spend the money and get the mail out, and then you would get, you know, you'd get leads in and you would get those motivated people. And now, you know, it's just those calls that you get where someone is they're just ready. They're super motivated. Mm-hmm. Are so few and far between compared to where they were last year, at least from what I'm experiencing, that it's just a different kind of thing. And, you know, one of the things I'm trying to do is with the Better Metrics is now I'm like every list that I have, which I wasn't doing before, I was tracking this previously last year. And then I just went to tracking the mail piece response rates, but now I'm back to every list, you know, which I should have been doing all along, has its own phone number. So at least I can track what lists my best leads are coming from and try to essentially double down on the ones that are working, because clearly a lot of stuff isn't working, even though I have 34 different niche lists, you know, that I'm mailing to and trying to be super sophisticated about it. And still, you know, I'm not getting the number of highly motivated people that I need to, you know, to be able to get the kind of revenue that I need. So that work in progress.
Right, right. No, I get it, man. I get it. And let me tell you, I was talking to some mutual friends of ours, and I think, you know, one guy said it best. I think is the more the tighter the market gets, the hotter the market. You know, the markets are pretty hot right now. The more archaic things are going back to as far as marketing is concerned. And what I mean by that is, I know people that are now deploying teams of door knockers.
Wow.
And doing things that. Yeah. You know, maybe don't sound sexy, right? But if you're just another postcard out there, it's just tough to stand out like that.
Yeah.
You know? You got to have a really, really interesting and you know, unique selling proposition. Why are sellers, what's going to make you different if you're just another postcard out there? And this is something I'm constantly challenging my team with. So we're looking at, you know, our credibility packages. We're looking at our process before an appointment, during an appointment, after an appointment, you know, how we're staying in contact with that person. And you got to look at all that stuff, man. That's why, again, it goes back to what I said. It's a simple business, but it's not really easy because there's just so many moving parts to it. But it's exciting, man. I mean, I think it will kind of end the show on this point. It goes back to what you said, John. It's an opportunity to learn, grow, and get better.
Absolutely. I mean, and if it was easy, it wouldn't be satisfying. You know, yeah. I mean, if it was, you know, just anything in life. So, you know, we have that at least.
Yep. Cool, man. Well, hey, brother. There's one question. I know you've heard a bunch of the shows, but one question I always kind of like to ask, man, is you're a young dude. I'm guessing you're in your early to mid 30s.
Yep.
All right. So rewind the clock 15 years. What do you? What's the one piece of advice you're telling the 20-year-old John Carcone?
It's not a great answer. I don't think I would just tell him to get started sooner. I definitely danced around it a lot longer than I should have. Mm-hmm. Looking back on it, I mean, college was an amazing experience. I learned a lot, but I kind of think it was a little bit of a waste too. If I got started in any way in this when I was 20, you know, instead of when I was 29 or whatever I was, you know, it would have been semi-retired by the time I was 30 instead of, you know, 40 or 45. So it's just to get started sooner probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen to your gut. And I think, you know, here's kind of my piggyback answer to that is, you know, somebody might be listening to this and they're 57 years old and they're like, I've always wanted to do real estate, but I'm too old now. I think that's a bullshit story. I think, you know, you are where you are and you can't change the past. So if you want to do something, do it, whether you're 57, 67, or you're 17, just do it. Who was it? There's a story about a super, super successful entrepreneur that the guy's, I think, is a billionaire now, and he didn't get started until he was 51, 52.
Really? Yeah. Well, I know that the KFC guy, I think, was 60, you know, and
maybe it's him that I'm thinking about, but he's not the only one that I've heard stories like that.
And Ray Kroc, I know, was 51 or 52, I think, when he McDonald's. I think there's a few of those kinds of examples.
Perfect example. Yeah. I mean, I don't watch a lot of movies, but I highly recommend you guys watch The Founder, you know, the story of Ray Kroc. And yeah, that dude wasn't young when he was, you know, trying to sell milkshakes out of the back of his car.
No, I mean, you know, you can't, like you said, I mean, you can't, what's happened is done. You know what I mean? You can't go back and relive it. You can't go back and change anything. So it's like, you just have the stretch of what you have in front of you, whether you're 60 or 20 or 14 or 70, right? And it's like, what are you going to do with it?
That's right. Awesome, buddy. Hey, John, man, again, I thank you for the time, man, and for just being real and for being vulnerable. I'm sure I'll catch up with you here in a couple of months when I see you. But where can people reach out, connect, and just kind of get to know you better?
Yeah, man. So, you know, my website is, it's called Four Brothers Buy Houses. So if people want to like check that out, and then I'm on Instagram and Facebook too. So that's probably the best way to reach me.
Okay, beautiful, man. Yeah, we'll have those links linked up in the show notes. So thanks for the time, buddy. You know, I appreciate you not only hopping on, but, you know, sharing with me that you've listened to the show. Hopefully you've gotten some value from it. And guys, you know, part of, I think, what I want to strive to continue to do on the podcast is not just give you the good, but also give you like what's not working and then what can you do or how can you think different? You know, because we all have these challenges, right? Myself included, John and everybody else, like we all have challenges. So it's, but how do you learn from it? How do you grow? And what are the opportunities that exist as a result of it? So, having said that, I'm going to sign off. John, appreciate you, buddy. We'll be in contact and I'll catch you guys in the next one.
Thanks, brother.
That's all for this episode of the Flip Empire Show. But we have you covered with even more expertise and resources on our website. Text EMPIRE to 67076 or head over to flipempire.com to join the newsletter and gain free instant access to our video module training course called 5 Ways to Scale Your Real Estate Wholesaling Business to 6 Figures in 6 Months or Less. For more interviews, strategies, and insights for the smart real estate investor, we'll catch you next time here on the Flip Empire Show.